This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Vimalakirti Sutra. Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, "Noble sir, how should a suffering bodhisattva practice their mind?" Vimalakirti replied, "Manjushri, a suffering bodhisattva should practice their own mind with the following consideration. Suffering arises from total involvement in the process of misunderstanding from beginningless time. It arises from the passions that result from unreal mental constructions. Hence, ultimately, nothing is perceived which can be said to be suffering. Why? The body is the issue of the four main elements, and in these elements there is no owner and no agent. There is no self in this body, and except for arbitrary insistence on self, ultimately no I, which can be said to be suffering, can be apprehended. Therefore, thinking I should not adhere to any self, and I should rest in the knowledge of the root of suffering, one should abandon the conception of themselves as a personality and produce the conception of themselves as a thing. Thinking this body is an aggregate of many things. When it is born, only things are born. When it ceases, only things cease. These things have no awareness or feeling of each other. When they are born, they don't think, I am born. And when they cease, they don't think, I cease. Furthermore, we should understand thoroughly the conception of oneself as a thing by cultivating the following consideration. Just as in the case of the conception of self, so the conception of thing is also a misunderstanding. And this misunderstanding is also suffering. I should free myself from this suffering and should strive to abandon it." So this weekend, we have been studying the precepts, those of us who are part of that retreat, and spent the day talking about the karma and looking at the importance of the three treasures and taking refuge as an essential part of what makes those moral teachings Buddha Dharma, and what is the role of Buddha Dharma and Sangha in a moral life. And in the afternoon, we spent our time looking at the precepts themselves from the point of view of understanding them directly, practicing them directly from the perspective of when necessary, for instance, to speak a non-truth, a falsehood, that we should do so only for the out of compassion and reverence for life, so that the precepts don't become fixed rules. We don't practice them as fixed rules, as a kind of formula that we impose upon a living, dynamic situation in which the imposition of that precept as a rule would actually create suffering rather than alleviate it. And we talked a lot about all of the things that appear within us, in our minds and bodies and emotions, in the world itself, that makes this so challenging. And what I wanted to do this morning is speak a little bit about the fundamental basis, the underlying basis of these teachings and of the precepts and of our world. We speak of the precepts and compassion as selfless wisdom. Wisdom itself, just the direct experience of the real nature of things, is in a sense wisdom, but without arms and legs. How does it function? Its functioning is compassion. How does the realization of emptiness, the realization of there is no owner and no agent, manifest in a body and in a mind and in time and space and in particular society and different bodies? I said on Friday night that the Buddha, in his enlightenment, realized that we're fundamentally moral beings. and to really reflect on this, in a sense, the simplicity of that, the magnitude of that, the implications of that. What does that mean, that we're moral beings? Because every action we take, every word we speak, every thought, the intentions, the desires those intentions are expressing, the views that are source of that, those intentions have impact. We affect each other. We're being affected. We affect ourselves by the actions, by our outward actions. We're experiencing those from within. And those impacts can be beneficial or not. And that affects us in particular ways, and that all has moral value, moral implications. And so we are moral beings. And because we live in this world, we experience this world as a moral world because we interact with not just people. I came across an article that some of the students sent me that kind of ties into this. It's a column in the Times by David Brooks, who's a conservative political and cultural commentator. And so he's talking about the market, and he says, I'm just pulling out a few lines here, he says, in a healthy society, people remember that? Have we ever had that, actually? But in a healthy society, people try to balance a whole bunch of different priorities. Economic, social, moral, familial. Somehow over the past 40 years, economic priorities took the top spot and obliterated everything else. I don't agree entirely with everything he's saying, but I think he has some important points here. As a matter of policy, we privileged economics and then eventually no longer could even see that there could be other priorities. We turned off the moral lens. You probably know, and then he talks about an example with in another country, a daycare center that was having problem with parents showing up late to pick up their children. And so to try and correct that, they started to fine the parents, a penalty. You know, they had to pay a price. And rather than diminishing the problem, it augmented it, because now, as he says, before, coming to pick up your children on time was a moral obligation. It was the right thing to do. He says for the staff workers, I think the kids deserve some inclusion in that as well, an obligation to your children. He says, but afterwards it was seen as an economic transaction. Parents were happy to pay a late fee. He says, we more or less did this as an entire society. We switched to a purely economic lens. He says, society can be seen as an atomized collection of individual economic units pursuing self-interest. Selfishness was normalized. Then he quotes a book where the author said, old-fashioned norms around loyalty, cooperation, honesty, equality, fairness, compassion no longer seem to apply in the economic sphere. Now, of course, he's speaking from as a white man and talking about these principles, these qualities, these virtues that apply as though they apply equally to everybody. That's not true. Then he goes on to say, social trust arises from a covenant. I give to my company, my town, my government, my community, and then I return back from all of those entities. He says, but that covenant has been torn apart. Now the general perception is when I give, they take. There's no reciprocity. He says, human beings are moral animals, and suddenly the American moral animals found themselves in an amoral economic system, which has felt increasingly alienating and gross. And he says, the critical question is not how can we have a good economy? The essential question is how can we have a good society? How can we have a society in which it's easier to be a good person? Such a simple question, such an important question. How can we make it easier for people to be good people? How do we make it easier for school or a corporation or government to be a good school, a good company, a good government? How do we make a religious community, a spiritual community, easier, make it easier for us to be a good community and good people in it? What an excellent question. The Buddha spoke of this in terms of all things, everything that we can perceive, is a result of karmic causes and conditions. And so we might think of those conditions as that environment, as what is necessary to create circumstances under which it is easier to be a good person, because Lord knows we know it can be hard to be a good person. And so rather than making it harder, which is what delusion does and what a deluded society does, we make it easier. That's what a monastery is. We try and make it easier. We say to practice, to liberate ourselves, but isn't that a way of saying to be a good person and to probe deeply into what is good? In the passage I read from Thanissaro on Friday night, and we talked a little bit more about yesterday, where he talks about the relationship between the teaching of karma as being based in intention, and that the precepts are that practicing these vows, these moral teachings, demand that we keep our attention focused on our intentions. That's not all we're focusing on. And intention itself, we also, it's important to understand, is not enough, because then there's also consequence of the intention. And sometimes our intentions have unintended consequences. And so all of that is important, but because every action arises from intentions, it helps us to bring our attention to that, which means then we get to see what are the desires that those intentions are expressing, what are the views that those desires arise out of, in which those desires make sense, because every desire makes sense within a certain view. And so he says the practice of observing the precepts or living an awakened life require, and it should be more than a requirement, I'm doing this because I'm required to do it, right? We talked a lot about how we want to shift that, right? So it's really coming from our own yearning, our own longing, our own spiritual imperative. I'm not doing this because this is the right thing to do, although it is the right thing to do, but because it is what I want to do, need to do, demand of myself, desire for myself to do. That it requires ceaseless attention to the factor of intention in one's actions, to develop the various qualities that will encourage that, to create the conditions that are conducive to my doing that, to us doing that together. He says, in this way, the Buddha's approach to morality is to use the realm of personal action, your Buddha field, as an arena for the comprehensive training of your mind. And so to understand that our field of our personal action doesn't have a clear boundary, right? That there is no solely personal realm of action, that we are constantly intermingling, influencing and being influenced, impacting and being impacted by our social realm, right? Our political realm, our economic realm, our gender realm, our racial realms. All the many realms of our mind that exist within and that we manifest without. And that in our socialized, conditioned world, in a deluded world, everything is assigned meaning. The Buddha said, when you turn your attention to the breath in your zazen, experience breath as breath. We should examine that deeply. What does that mean? Breath as breath, nothing more, nothing adorned. It doesn't mean something. That's why practicing the breath is so important, so valuable, because on a certain level we know it doesn't mean anything. It's just a breath. It's a biological function. But that doesn't keep us from infusing it with meaning in various moments. So we can't separate the personal from the social. the present from the past, the body from the mind. Intention from impact. Delusion from enlightenment. And so what is the best inner world we can create or perhaps return to be a good person, to be an enlightened being, an awake being, a moral being? What is the way to liberate inner and outer, self and other, personal and social? And so the basic teaching of Buddhism is to cease from harm, to do all that is good, and to study your mind. And so when Vimalakirti says that a suffering being should practice their mind by considering this, and by consideration he means examine this carefully, that suffering arises from our total involvement in the process of misunderstanding from beginningless time. So one of the teachings, one of the sort of ways of speaking about the plausibility, if you will, of rebirth, is that the depth and degree and the tenacity of our own attachments and our delusion couldn't just be the results of these few years we've been alive. Right? This must be the result of lifetimes of endeavor. Right? So when Vimalakirti says from beginningless time, he means all the way back. And he says it arises from the passions. So what he's saying is that we are moment to moment deeply involved in something, in an enterprise, in a project of being that has been going on for a long time, and that project is in a process, that we are engaged actively in a process of misunderstanding. Uh-oh. Of not understanding clearly. We understand. We have an understanding. But is our understanding clear? What does that mean? Is it in accord, in alignment with what it actually is? This arises from the passions, and passions in Buddhism means the sort of gnarled and entanglements, the entanglements of our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings, our desires. Not that they in and of themselves are entangling, but that they can become, we get entangled in them, that result from unreal mental constructions. Why are they unreal? Mental constructions means everything that appears in the mind, the building blocks of thoughts and plans and memories and rehashed conversations and judgments. Why unreal? Something's there. There is a reality, but what is the nature of that reality? And so the example that's often used in Buddhism is of the magician, right, who by the deftness of their hands and skill are able to show you something. You're seeing something, but what their skill is in your not seeing, what they don't want you to see, which is happening right in front of us. I remember watching a video clip of a guy who was like a master, he was a magician, but he was also a master pickpocket dude. And there was a circle of people, and the whole thing was about him being a pickpocket. And there was a circle of people, and he said, "I'm going to take something from each one of you." Like everybody knew what the deal was. And then he just, as they were just standing there and talking, he just walked very simply, very casually around. And I was watching, we're all set up, and I'm watching. I don't see anything. And then he comes back around, and they're all like, "I thought you were going to take something from me." And he starts opening up his pockets. Watches, wallets, small things, big things. It was amazing. So right in plain view, His skill was hiding what he wanted us not to see. And so the unreal mental construction is that we see something, and we see something which, in a sense, our delusion designs us to see. For what purpose? For the purpose of this sense of owner and agent, for the sense of being, having the sense that I am the person I want to be, which means I have to hide the rest of me that is not that person. And so he says, and hence, ultimately nothing is perceived which can be said to be suffering. Why? Why is this? Because, I mean, this is such an outrageous statement, right? Mm-hmm. Because it sounds as though he's denying that there's suffering in the world, that you experience it. How could he say such a thing? Hence, ultimately, nothing can be perceived which can be said to be suffering. But he knows this, and so he says, why? He's asking for us. The body, everything that we call the body, issues forth from the four main elements, earth, air, fire, and water, all of those materials that exist within us. And in each of those elements, when we examine carefully, closely, within a state of deep concentration, not intellectually, not conceptually, but directly, your own experience, what do you find? No owner, no agent. There is no self, no personhood, no essential you that can be found. In this body, and except for our arbitrary insistence, but no, here I am. I'm the one who is sitting. I'm the one who's examining. I'm the one who's in pain. Aside from that, he says, ultimately there is no I. In other words, the sense of self only exists when we're engaged in that total involvement of experience things from that sense of self. Without that, there is no sense of self because there is no self. It is only a sense. And therefore, therefore there is no one who is suffering. There is suffering. There is pain. But there is no one who is suffering. But what about the suffering itself? What about the pain itself? When you bump your head, you cut yourself, that's a physical action. Your body is wired to respond in a certain way. Right? It would be dangerous if it doesn't do that. But what is that pain? So if you take that pain as a body, right? Like this is a body, just take the pain, take that sensation as a body and examine it carefully in a state of deep concentration. We find no owner of that pain, no agency in that pain. It's just sensation. And when we look more deeply into that sensation, the sensation itself cannot be found. Therefore, thinking I should not adhere to any self, or I should rest in the knowledge of the root of illness. And so he says, how can we work with this, right? Because we're so embedded in that sense of solidity. I'm here, I exist. The pain is real, I feel it. And he says, well, try this. He says, try just relaxing, abandoning, letting go of that sense of personality. Right? And so this is what we do in Zazen. So when a thought arises, you just experience it as thought, not your thought. In other words, don't take possession of it. Don't become the owner of that thought. Don't reestablish that as the truth. Because you can see if when we do that, that's something I'm involved in. I'm actively creating that agency, that ownership. What if I don't do that? What if I just experience it as thought? A mental energy that takes a certain form, or a sensation as sensation. And so he says, if we relax that and then just think of it as a thing. Oh, here's a thing, an object. We give it a name, thought, but it's really just, it has some thingness quality, right? What's the purpose of that? Is to create a kind of space, because we're so emotionally involved, so invested in what we call personality, in being me. And so what if we just relax that a little bit? Not to turn ourselves into a machine, that's not what he's saying. It's just to experience it with more spaciousness. Because when, you know, we know that when we experience something with a deep investment in it being a certain way, that's what we see. Because that's what we need to see. So what if we just relax that investment? What is it when I don't have that? When I'm just looking calmly? Then we see that when a thing is born, a thought is born, it's just a thing that's born. It's not me, it's not mine. I don't have to possess it, I don't have to defend it, I don't have to destroy it. I'm not at odds with it, I'm at peace. We have a peaceful coexistence. And then he says, but now go further and realize that even seeing things as a thing is ultimately the same thing. Right? It's still a conception, it's still a construction, it's still a kind of involvement. It's more spacious, it allows us to see things more clearly, allows us to practice things more easily, lightly. But go further and see that that thing itself is also a kind of misunderstanding. And that's sort of what upaya is bringing a sort of a healthier kind of misunderstanding, right? A less diluted, a less solid, a less attached kind of understanding, right? To help us to release a little bit, take a step, take a step, take a step, until finally we let go entirely of the construction altogether. What is the fundamental basis of morality? What is an intention? What is an action? We know what it looks like. We know how we experience an intention in our minds, how we would express it in words. We can feel the desire within it. If we examine, we can see the view. In that action, we can see the consequence. We can endeavor to cultivate compassion. We might even feel compassion. But what are those things? When we examine them, do we find an owner? Is there an agent? Do they have their own agency? Yesterday I said that when we commit an action, small or large, it's like kind of like giving a gift to the world, right? And that action is like dropping a pebble into a pond. It starts rippling out. That's the nature of karma. And that it moves forward, but it doesn't move forward on its own. It doesn't have its own agency. That when you drop a pebble in the water, the reason it ripples is because of the nature of water. And gravity and weight and disturbance, and I'm not a physicist, so I can't say more than that. But there's a whole system there. It's not that the pebble itself is acting alone or that the waves themselves are just, it's acting within its environment. And that environment for us is everything. That's why to be a Dharma practitioner and to examine our personal realm of personal action, and then to more and more see that personal is not just what I see as mine, or even what I recognize as the various realms of action, but even more importantly, it's what I don't see. What I don't see is mine, and what I don't see is not mine. And so there, the sense of blindness that is so often used to describe delusion is such an apt kind of way of thinking of it, because it's like seeing, being blind, but our eyes actually work and are open. Or if we're trying to unravel, disassemble racism or sexism, various forms of oppression or biased being, what are the things that we don't see? And then how do we see what we don't see? We can't do it in isolation. We can't do it, it's like I was saying to somebody earlier, we can't, you know, with a sense of suffering and the sense that there has to be a possibility of something else. I mean, I think, isn't that the seed of bodhicitta? Both of those have to be there. We have to recognize dukkha, but we also have to recognize there has to be something else. I know that there is something else, because otherwise nothing would move. And so how do we, but so knowing that, if it's just like, okay, well, I'm just going to figure this out, right? We're not going to get very far, right? Because we're relying on our own mind and everything, which is already clearly limited because I am suffering, to reveal what I can't see, which I'm not seeing. And so we have to take refuge in the teachings. We have to rely upon the experience of somebody who has done what we have a sense can be done. You know how life never turns out like you thought? Talks often are like that. And this is such an important, I mean, this is the, in a sense, the essence of Buddhism, the fundamental. Because without this, what Vimalakirti is speaking about, then really what we would be left with is just working within the world of the relative, right? Our behavior, our actions, our good intentions, and trying to, you know, be as good a person as we could be, create as good as conditions as we could do, but knowing that fundamentally we can only go so far. Because fundamentally, all of this is as it appears to be. There is inside and outside. There are clear boundaries. We do exist fundamentally. Therefore, I do need to defend. I do need to protect. I will perceive you as a threat. Because of the Buddha's enlightenment, because of what Vimalakirti is talking about, liberation is not only possible, but it's our nature. And yet, it's a very, like anything that has a lot of power, the power to transform a life, the power to free us of suffering, it has to be used well. You know, some people were coming during the week to clean the chimney downstairs, but a fire was building. So Steve and Renji or Eve had taken live burning logs and coals out and put them into a bucket, right, to clean out the stove so they could clean it. So we were all standing there looking at it, and meanwhile the room is filling up with smoke. And I said, so we got to carry this outside. And somebody said, how are you going to carry it? Right. I said, you have to pick it up with your arms. So how do we carry this? How do we hold this? How do we wield, how do we work with that dangerous teaching? Dangerous because if we misunderstand it, we can misunderstand it terribly. To be saying, I see that you're suffering, but your suffering is not real. The sutra says so. I see that people claim there is injustice in the world, but injustice is empty. It doesn't actually exist. There is ultimately nothing which can be said to be unjust. And so, and since the beginning of Buddhism, that danger has been present, and the teachings responding to that danger. That's why when that is taught, it's so important that it be, you know, attended to, carefully understood. And so Vimalakirti goes on to say, the suffering bodhisattva should recognize that sensation is ultimately non-cessation, is free of sensation. In pain, in a moment of just physical pain, when you look carefully, there is nothing in it that you can find that is pain. In compassion, there's nothing in it that we can find that is compassion. There's only the moment that is a result of karmic causes and consequences and the conditions that that moment appears in, and there is action. He says, we should recognize that within sensation, ultimately, there is nothing that can be found, but we should not strive to realize the cessation of sensation. In other words, that doesn't mean, therefore, stop having sensation, stop feeling. Although both pleasure and pain are abandoned, we are freed from, we see through to the real nature of these Buddha qualities when we develop ourselves more fully. There is no sacrifice of the great compassion for all living beings, living in difficult migrations. Thus we recognize in our own suffering the infinite sufferings of every living being, and therefore the bodhisattva correctly contemplates all living beings and resolves to do whatever they can to alleviate their suffering. At the same time that they're doing everything they can to alleviate their own suffering. And so he's saying that to conceptually, and it can only be conceptual, conclude that because things have no owner and agent, therefore, in essence, nothing matters. There's nothing to be done. That's just more suffering arising from total involvement in a process of misunderstanding. But now we're calling it Dharma or enlightenment. And so it has an extra little... But that's really the worst, in Buddhism, that's like the worst kind of delusion. And so it's acknowledging at every moment the validity of a person's experience. And also at the very same moment, recognizing in that very experience is our liberation. In its very nature. And that doesn't mean that anyone or everyone, well, it doesn't mean that everyone will hear that teaching and be drawn to it or want to practice and realize that. But the bodhisattva knows that that's true because they see it. And that profoundly affects how they work with their own suffering and how they work with the suffering of others. Because if we believe that it's solid and fixed and permanent and divisible, then all we can do is kind of mitigate. All we can do is have sort of established peace treaties for the moment. But in the sense of anything ultimate. A teacher, this is all part of the talk that's not going to happen. The teacher said, when the 10 positive actions, let's say the 10 precepts, when the precepts are not associated with the path of wisdom and compassion, they constitute a temporary or impermanent kind of virtue. For since they fall within the ambit or the realm of delusion, they produce only a single happy result within samsara and then is exhausted. And so when we are just trying to be good people and trying to live a good life and doing good things, there is an act, an experience of virtue, right? That we are tapping into, that we are manifesting. And there is an experience of uplift or joyfulness or happiness or satisfaction that arises from that. It's happening within samsara, and it will be exhausted. It will come and go. And so he says this is referred to as the virtue that leads to happiness. He says if, on the other hand, the following of these precepts, these teachings are associated, are embedded within a path, within the path, they are the cause of enlightenment. And for this reason, they are referred to as virtues leading to liberation. And so again, it's recognizing that people all over the world are good people, living good lives, trying to do the right thing. And experiencing moments, and small and large, short and long, that are arising from virtue and that lead to happiness, that's true. And that shouldn't be diminished, because those are meaningful and they enrich lives. And they can also, both in their arising and also in their exhaustion, can also lead us to inquire deeper, to look more, to want more, in a sense. But it also recognizes that there is a path of liberation. There is a path that is within our thoughts, words, and actions, our intentions, our the consequences of our actions, and all that we call practice, that within all of that there is also a path of liberation that is based in. There is no owner and agent. That fundamentally there is no possession of suffering or happiness, of delusion or enlightenment. And that is our enlightenment. We are liberated because there is no possession. We're not liberated in spite of there being. It's like, you know, within such a sort of self-serving culture, it's like no owner, no agent sounds like just a lot of bad news. Like, it feels like a very destitute place, right? If I'm not experiencing all of this, if I don't get to have all of this, and that's why we have to practice is realize that's just sort of the view from that place of having faith in and wanting to continue that sense of possession as the path to happiness. So just consider, you know, in your own experience, whether that be short or long, when you let go of something beautiful, when you let go of the attachment to it, does that burden you? Does that dampen your spirit? Does that discourage you? Does that make you smaller? What is the actual experience? Or does it give you a sense of something larger, more joyful, because there is no attachment to it? Because this moment of happiness is not anxious-ridden, because you know you're going to lose it. You know you're going to lose it. You know you've never had it. It's just this. Who would want to miss it then? Whereas when we're attached to it, we're already missing it. Because we're already scared about losing it and looking for how we're going to replace it. And so that's why practice is so important, because it helps to decrease our doubt that, wait a minute, I'm not sure I want this, because I'm going to lose all the good stuff. And then we begin to see, well, wait a minute, all the good stuff wasn't all good. And what am I actually losing? What does losing mean? What does letting go mean? So I'll end with a poem. So many doors, so many concerns. When the sun sets and the darkening comes, then how is it? Day and night, each creature, flesh, scale, feather, bark. Nothing stands in non-established dignity. Sorry, forget I just said that. Day and, start over, I misread that. Okay. Take a sip of something, clean your palate. So many doors, so many concerns. When the sun sets and the darkening comes, how is it? Day and night, each creature, flesh, scale, feather, and bark, stands in non-established dignity. Nothing propped up is the signless feature of strength and wholeness.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.